Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Ezra chapter 3. We're going to do all 12 verses of this chapter, which I will entitle Rebuilding the Altar and the Temple. Our context is this. In our last chapter, we have seen the exiles return from Babylon. They went there in 586 when Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon burnt down Jerusalem. They stayed there in Babylon until 538 when Cyrus, the new sheriff in town who had just taken over from the Babylonians in 539, the next year in 538, he issued his famous Edict of Cyrus, which said, Israelites, go back to Israel and rebuild the temple. So in 538, they did so. And so here we are now in Ezra 3, 1 through 3, and we'll see that they've been there for a couple of years by the time we finish the chapter, by the time the foundation of the temple has been finished, which would be 536. So that's our general time frame. So let's start with Ezra 3, 1 through 3. Now, when the seventh month came and the sons of Israel were in the cities, the people gathered together as one man to Jerusalem. Then Jeshua, the son of Jozadak, and his brothers the priest, and Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and his brothers arose and built the altar of the God of Israel to offer burnt offerings on it, as it is written in the law of Moses, the man of God. So they set up the altar on its foundation, for they were terrified because of the peoples of the lands, and they offered burnt offerings on it to the Lord, burnt offerings morning and evening. Now when the seventh month came, this is the seventh month of the religious year, not the civil year, and the seventh month of the religious year was Tishri, September and October by our reckoning. I found 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 commentators says that it's Tishri. However, there's some other options. It could be the seventh month after they left Babylon, as the Cambridge commentary and Benson claim, or at least mention. Or it could be the seventh month after they arrived in Jerusalem. But we're going to take it as Tishri, especially since the Feast of Tabernacles is mentioned here shortly hereafter in verse 4. So this is Tishri. As I said, it's the month of the Feast of Tabernacles. It's also the holiest month of the year. Tishri 1, you had Rosh Hashanah. That's the Feast of Trumpets that was held on the first of the month of Tishri. There was a Feast of Trumpets on the beginning of every month, and the one at the beginning of Tishri is now called by the Jews Rosh Hashanah, head of the year, New Year's Day. And then 10 days later, Tishri 10, Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. And then Tishri 15, you got Sukkot, the Feast of Tabernacles. So, a holy month, the people gathered together in Jerusalem. Now notice that the sons of Israel were in the cities. They didn't just come back to Jerusalem when they came back from Babylon. They came back to the cities too, and those would be the cities around Jerusalem. The people gathered together as one man to Jerusalem. Ellicott says it's not all of the exiles as one man, meaning every last one of them, but it means with one consent. They came with one mind, in other words, to Jerusalem. And that mind was, of course, is to rebuild the altar and the temple. Verse 2, then Jeshua, the son of Jozadak, and his brothers. Jeshua is mentioned. He's also known as Joshua. It depends on what vowel you put there in the word. And some translations have Joshua. This is Jeshua in ESB. Jeshua, the son of Jozadak. Now, he's the high priest for the returning exiles. Now, Ezra doesn't call him the high priest, but Jeshua was the high priest, as the pulpit commentary points out. Jeshua's position right here makes it clear that Jeshua was the high priest, because we read here in verse 2 that Jeshua, along with Zerubbabel, built the altar of God in Israel. Well, that makes sense. You got the high priest and you got the governor, Zerubbabel, the chief religious official and the chief political official building the altar. That makes sense. And besides, we have it explicitly told to us in Haggai and Zechariah that Jeshua was the high priest. Haggai 1:1. In the second year of King Darius, the word of the Lord came through Haggai, to Joshua, son of Jehozadak, the same as Jozadak, the high priest. So in Haggai 1:1, Jeshua is called Joshua. Remember, Jeshua and Joshua, the same person. Haggai 1:14, and this is the Holman Christian Study Bible translation. Haggai 1:14, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Zerubbabel, son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, the spirit of the high priest Joshua, son of Jehozadak, same guy. Haggai 2:2, speak to Zerubbabel, son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, to the high priest Joshua, son of Jehozadak. Zechariah 3:1, moving from Haggai to Zechariah, then he showed me Joshua the high priest. So I got a couple more verses. I won't beat the dead horse there. It's the same person, Joshua the son of Jehozadak. He's the high priest. Now Zerubbabel is the governor of the new nation of Israel. It's really Judah, but we're going to call it Israel since the northern tribes are gone, so we'll call it Israel now. He's called the son of Shealtiel, and that shows that he is therefore the grandson of Jehoiakim, the next to last king of Judah, the Jehoiakim who was carried off into exile in 597 BC by Babylon, not 586, but 597, and he was put in jail by Nebuchadnezzar. And then Nebuchadnezzar's son, Evil Merodach, probably met him in jail because the story is he got tossed into jail for doing something bad when he had taken over for his father Nebuchadnezzar, when Nebuchadnezzar thought he was a cow munching on grass. At any rate, that's the same Jehoiakim we're talking about. He was let out of jail and given a bunch of food, let to sit at the honored places in the kingdom of Babylon. Well, that Jehoiakim was Zerubbabel's grandfather, which is kind of interesting. Well, how do we know that? Well, we can look in 1 Chronicles 3:17, the sons of Jeconiah. Now, Jeconiah is Jehoiakim is the same person. The sons of Jeconiah the captive, he's been put in jail, as I just said. The sons of Jeconiah, his sons, Shealtiel, So Jeconiah had a son, Shealtiel, and then, of course, Shealtiel is said right here in Ezra 3 to be the father of Zerubbabel. So Zerubbabel is the grandson of the famous captive king in Babylon. We also read the same information in the genealogy of Jesus, Matthew 1, verses 12 to 13. Then after the exile to Babylon, Jeconiah, and that's the same thing as Jehoiakim, Jeconiah fathered Shealtiel, Shealtiel fathered Zerubbabel. And then Zerubbabel fathered and on it goes on down to the time of Jesus. So Zerubbabel was a grandson of a king of Judah, and he was the ancestor, one of the ancestors of Jesus. He's no small guy. Now, there's one little reconciliation problem here. There's many, many places where he's called. Zerubbabel is called the son of Shealtiel. There's one place, however, he's called the son of Padeah. That's in 1 Chronicles 3:19, Padeah's sons, Zerubbabel and Shimei. Well, how is it that Shealtiel is called Padeah's son and not Shealtiel's son? Well, there's a couple of options to reconcile that. Here's one from gotquestions.org. Padeah is, or could be, Shealtiel's brother, and he substitutes for Shealtiel via levirate marriage when Shealtiel dies. 1 Chronicles 3:17 through 19, the sons of Jeconiah, that's Jehoiakim the captive, his sons Shealtiel, Padeah, So you see, Jeconiah had a lot of sons, and two of them were brothers, Shealtiel and Padeah. So if we assume that Shealtiel dies prematurely, Padeah takes over, and so he is now in the genealogy instead of Shealtiel, and so then Zerubbabel would said to be his son. That's one way of reconciling it. The other way of reconciling it is by saying there's a simple scribal error in 1 Chronicles 3:18, and, excuse me, 1 Chronicles 3:19, and the verse should say Shealtiel's son, Zerubbabel, not Padeah's son, Zerubbabel. All right, so the civil and religious leaders, Zerubbabel, the political leader, and Jeshua, the religious leader, the high priest, they start to work. And what's the first thing they build? Did they build the temple first? No, they build the altar first. That's in verse 3. That's the big bronze altar in the front of where the temple is going to be. It's not built yet. It's always logical to worship first and build second. Great application point for all of you preachers out there that want to give a sermon application here. You want to build something in your life, in your career, in your family, in your whatever, in your church. It might be a good idea to worship God first. Get his take on the matter before you go rushing off in your flesh. And how many Christians, maybe 100% of all Christians, have violated that? So they built the altar of burnt offering. We're going to see a lot of burnt offerings are going to go up on that altar here shortly. So verse 3 says this, so they set up the altar on its foundation, for they were terrified because of the peoples of the land. That's why they built that altar up. They needed religious security. They needed security from their God in the face of very real opposition because of all the pagan neighbors. Now, who are these pagan neighbors? Well, they are pagans from all over the ancient Near East that the Assyrians had shipped in when the Assyrians had captured the area. They had captured the northern 10 tribes of Israel in 722 BC, when Sargon II burnt Samaria down. So all of these pagans are in the north of Israel, and they're not going to be happy with a bunch of Jews coming in and setting up their kingdom in the midst of their pagan lands. Sort of sounds like present-day Israel in the teeth of the Arabs, with all the trouble they've had doing that. But it's ironic that the very act of building this bronze altar probably alienated their neighbors even worse. Ancient pagans were very territorial about their gods, and they're thinking, hey, our God, whatever it was, he's in charge here, and now you're setting up Yahweh in charge? Just who do you think you are? And we'll see this opposition from the pagans all around, all the way through the books of Ezra and Nehemiah. But notice that the opposition was so bad that they were terrified, which is a pretty strong word. The Home of Christian Study Bible doesn't translate it quite so strongly. They say, they use the word feared. They feared the surrounding peoples. So I'm not sure. I don't know Hebrew. I don't know what the correct nuance is there. But they were scared of the people around, and so they offer burnt offerings to the Lord. Now, of course, a burnt offering is a whole burnt offering, is what the Hebrew means there, and a whole burnt offering means the whole sacrifice is offered on the altar as an act of total consecration and dedication to God. As the smoke goes up to God, that means the whole offering goes up to God, and that symbolizes the fact that the offeror is putting himself completely in the hands of God. And so these burnt offerings went up morning and evening. Those are the famous evening and morning sacrifices, morning and evening sacrifices that were prescribed in Numbers 28, verses 3 through 4. And say to them, God tells Moses, this is the fire offering you are to present to the Lord. Each day present two unblemished year-old male lambs as a regular burnt offering. Offer one lamb in the morning and the other lamb at twilight. And so this is a very well-known. The idea is constantly, we are constantly offering up daily, morning and evening, we're offering ourselves up to you. So we go now to Ezra chapter 3, verses 4 through 6. They celebrated the Feast of Booths, as it is written. Feast of Booths, of course, is Tishri 15th, the harvest festival. They built these little ramshackle makeshift huts that they lived in order to symbolize the fact that that's how they had to live when they were on the Exodus. So they celebrated the Feast of Booths and offered the fixed number of burnt offerings daily, according to the ordinances each day required. Well, a fixed number of burnt offerings daily, as John Gill and Matthew Poole say, that refers to each of the 8 days of the Feast of Tabernacles. Because if you'll look in Leviticus, which we're not going to do, we've already done that, but each of those 8 days of the Feast of Tabernacles required a certain number of burnt offerings. The fixed number of burnt offerings, Ezra calls it here in chapter 3, verse 4. And we'll see here that Ezra he's a priest. He's very careful to show that the returning Israelites are doing everything according to the book of the law. We're doing it exactly how God told Moses to do it. We're doing it. It says in verse 4, according to the ordinance. That would be according to the law of Moses back in Leviticus, as each day required. And afterward, there was a continual burnt offering. There's a couple of options as to what that meant. It could mean the evening and morning sacrifices for those 8 days of the Feast of Tabernacles. Or it could be the ordinary daily morning and evening sacrifice for every day, not just the 8 days of the Feast of Tabernacles. The Cambridge Commentary says that. I tend to disagree with the Cambridge Commentary. It sounds to me like these are burnt offerings that are offered after the special burnt offerings for the 8 day Feast of Sukkot, Feast of Tabernacles. You had the ordinary daily, evening, and morning sacrifices on those special days too. And the reason I say that is because the ordinary daily, morning, and evening sacrifices were already mentioned in verse 3. They offered burnt offerings on the altar to the Lord, burnt offerings morning and evening. That's just speculation. At any rate, the point here is that Ezra is very, very careful to include all the burnt offerings that are required by law. And even if it's not exactly clear to us, he knew what he was supposed to do and he was doing it to the T. Now in verse 5, this continual burnt offering, whenever it was, during the 8 days of the Feast of Tabernacle, or on every day, whenever it was continual. That word continual means that they were never neglected. Of course, it doesn't mean they burnt 24/7. It just means that every morning and every evening they were offered, they weren't neglected. Now in verse 5, there are other offerings mentioned that the people did, for the new moons and for all the fixed festivals. Now, there's a ambiguity here Is this referring for burnt offerings that are offered, that are required to be offered for the new moons and for all the fixed festivals? Or is it just talking about the normal sacrifices, whatever they may be, burnt offerings otherwise, for the new moons and for the fixed festivals? The Cambridge commentary says it's not clear if it's referring to new burnt offerings or rather just the normal offerings for that new moon festival or for all the fixed festivals. It doesn't really matter. What are fixed festivals? Those are the three great annual festivals that the Israelites, all the men, were supposed to go to Jerusalem to celebrate. These festivals, according to the Cambridge commentary, are the Passover, the Feast of Weeks, Passover in spring, Feast of Weeks in early summer, Feast of Tabernacles in Tishri, September, October. We read about these three annual feasts in 2 Chronicles 8:13. He, referring to Solomon, followed the daily requirement for offerings according to the commandment of Moses for Sabbaths, new moons, and the three annual appointed festivals. The Festival of Unleavened Bread, which is Passover, the Festival of Weeks, and the Festival of Booths. So those three feasts are mentioned by name. Those are the fixed festivals. They were also carried out. Sabbath is not mentioned, but I'm sure they were honoring the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Now, in verse 6, it says, from the first day of the seventh month, they began to offer burnt offerings to the Lord. Now, of course, the first day of the seventh month is Tishri 1. That's Rosh Hashanah, which is a feast of a new moon festival. They blew trumpets on that day, and they began to offer burnt offerings to the Lord. From the first day, they weren't finished all the way through Tishri. Burnt offerings everywhere. The required burnt offerings for the Feast of Tabernacles, for example. There's a whole ton of them that were required to be offered on day 1 through day 8. But the foundation of the temple of the Lord had not been laid. So they were just using the altar with no temple to offer these burnt offerings. So the Cambridge commentary summarizes all the burnt offerings that were offered. As it says in verse 6, from the first day of the seventh month, they began to offer burnt offerings. What burnt offerings? Well, according to the summary of the Cambridge commentary, we have, first of all, the daily morning and evening sacrifices, burnt offerings. Second, the new moon burnt offerings. Thirdly, the burnt offerings on all the fixed feast, Passover, Weeks, and Tabernacles. And then fourthly, the burnt offerings on the occasion of free will offerings. Because it says here in verse 5, a burnt offering was offered from everyone who offered a free will offering to the Lord. A free will offering, of course, is just like it says, you feel like giving something to God. It was considered a special kind of peace offering or fellowship offering. So at any rate, not to get bogged down like we were in Leviticus over all these offerings, the point is that the people are pouring out their hearts to God. This is true, genuine religious revival. We go now to Ezra 3:7. Then they gave money to the masons and carpenters and food, drink, and oil to the Sidonians and to the Tyrians to bring cedar wood from Lebanon to the sea at Yappa according to the permission they had from Cyrus, king of Persia. Now, of course, the permission is the famous edict of Cyrus in 538. Cyrus might have also given money to help the Israelites reestablish their temple. Some people have speculated. We do know that he required the remaining Jews who stayed behind in Babylon to help finance the exiles' return. Now, these people that are said to bring cedar wood from Lebanon, they're Sidonians and Tyrians. That's, of course, the two famous coastal cities. They're in Phoenicia on the Lebanese coast. Interesting that the New American Standard Bible says that the cedar wood comes from Lebanon. I thought that was a modern term. That might be a little anachronistic. The Holman Christian Study Bible doesn't say Lebanon. But anyway, it's up there on the Lebanese coast. Tyre is just south of Sidon on the coast, right as you get past Mount Carmel going up the Mediterranean coast. Now, they also gave money to masons and carpenters, the people who actually had to build the temple, and they had to have materials for the temple, and that would be cedar wood from Lebanon. Of course, the cedars of Lebanon are incredibly famous all throughout the Old Testament. Now, the cedar wood came from Lebanon. They cut the trees down, put the trees on ships in the Mediterranean, and go south to the seaport at Joppa, which is still there. That's J-O-P-P-A, by the way. I pronounce it Joppa because when I was in Israel, that's what they called it. I assume that's how you pronounce it. And so the people are gearing up to build the temple. We go now to Ezra 3, verses 8 through 11. Now in the second year, they're coming to the house of God at Jerusalem in the second month. Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Jeshua, the son of Jozadak, and the rest of their brothers, the priests and the Levites, and all who came from the captivity to Jerusalem, began the work and appointed the Levites from 20 years and older to oversee the work of the house of the Lord. Then Jeshua with his sons and brothers stood united with Kadmiel and his sons, the sons of Judah, and the sons of Henadad with their sons and brothers, the Levites, to oversee the workmen in the temple of God. Now when the builders had laid the foundation of the temple of the Lord, the priests stood in their apparel with trumpets, and the Levites, the sons of Asaph, with cymbals, to praise the Lord according to the directions of King David of Israel. They sang, praising and giving thanks to the Lord, saying, "For he is good, for his loving kindness is upon Israel forever." And all the people shouted with a great shout when they praised the Lord, because the foundation of the house of the Lord was laid. Now, verse 8 says, "Now in the second year of their coming," that would be 536, Walward and Zuck have got an article that say it's in May or June of 536. I would not pretend to be that precise. I cannot be because I don't know that much. But 536 is a strong date. It's a date that everybody agrees with. That's when the beginning of the foundation of the temple was laid. Now, one of the options as to measuring the 70 years of captivity, according to the famous prophecy in Jeremiah, one of those options would use 536 as an ending date, 605, when Daniel was taken off into captivity by the Babylonians, and then the temple is begun to be laid here in 536. Well, 605 minus 536 is 70 years. I prefer the option 586 to 516. 586, destruction of the temple. 516, the completion of the new temple. 586 to 516, 70 years, that works pretty good for me, but I'm not going to be really dogmatic on that point. Now you notice in verse 8 that the Levites were appointed. Doesn't say who did it. Was it Zerubbabel? Was it all the people voted on them? I don't know, but the Levites got appointed to oversee the work of rebuilding the temple. Well, that's logical. The Levites were the ones legally in charge of the temple service, so it's logical they'd be in charge of the construction of the temple. I mean, they were responsible for keeping the doors, for singing, for security, to keep people out that weren't supposed to be in, collecting money, chopping up sacrifices. They did all the scut work of the temple. It makes sense they would build the temple. Now, verse 9 is very confusing. Cambridge commentator says if you read verse 9, it's very confusing to the English reader. Let me read it again, and I just want you to notice some names as we go through. These names, some people say represent two families, some people say they represent three families, and some people say they represent four families, according to the Cambridge commentary. Then Jeshua with his sons and brothers stood united with Kadmiel, the sons of Judah, and the sons of Henadad, the Levites. So you got Judah, Levites, Henadad, Kadmiel, Jeshua. And to make it even more complicated, some people say that this Jeshua is not the high priest Jeshua, which I find hard to believe. Well, I'm not going to get into all of that. That's extremely complicated. The point is that some prominent families helped the Levites oversee the temple construction work. Now, in verse 10, it says, "When the builders had laid the foundation of the temple of the Lord, time to celebrate. We got the foundations built. The priests stood in their apparel with trumpets, and the Levites, the sons of Asaph, with cymbals." Trumpets and cymbals to celebrate the foundation. Now, this is interesting because in the times of David, we also have Levites who were called the sons of Asaph, and we also had priests, and we had Asaph's clanging cymbals in David's time, and we had priests blowing trumpets in David's time, and that's exactly what we've got here. First of all, let's look at 1 Chronicles 25, 1 through 2, and we will see that the sons of Asaph were specifically mentioned as being part of the musical work in David's time. 1 Chronicles 25, 1 through 2, "David and the officers of the army also set apart some of the sons of Asaph, Heman, Jeduthun, who were to prophesy accompanied by lyres, harps, and cymbals." This is the list of the men who performed their service from Asaph's sons, ... All of these sons prophesied under the authority of the king. Now this is interesting. When David brought the ark to Jerusalem, famous incident in David's life, the priest blew trumpets and Asaph sounded cymbals. 1 Chronicles 16, 5 through 6, Asaph sounded the cymbals, verse 6, and the priest, ... blew the trumpets regularly before the ark of the covenant of God. cymbals and trumpets in the time of David bringing the ark back to Jerusalem. And so likewise here in 536, after the foundation of the temple was laid, the priests blew trumpets, and the sons of Asaph, the descendants of Asaph, played the cymbals to praise the Lord according to the directions of King David. I read you the verses that show that the Levites who were of the sons of Asaph were established in the time of David. Notice how music is so important. Along with prayer and sacrifice and worship is music, singing and praising. I just cannot emphasize enough how much singing and praising is important in the Christian life. And I think every Christian knows this instinctively. Almost every service I ever saw has music in it. People sing praise to God. And all the people shouted with a great shout in verse 11 when they praised the Lord because the foundation of the temple had been laid. Now, it's interesting to me that right after they finished praising the Lord, they quit building the temple. I guess that's another good point. You got to do both. You got to praise the Lord, and then you got to go out and do the work. It's not a false dichotomy. It's not an either or. It's a both and. They quit working after they finished praising the Lord. We now go to verses 12 through 13 of Ezra 3, and we'll be finished with this chapter. Yet many of the priests and Levites and heads of fathers' households, the old men who had seen the first temple, wept with a loud voice when the foundation of this house was laid before their eyes, while many shouted aloud for joy, so that the people could not distinguish the sound of the shout of joy from the sound of the weeping of the people. For the people shouted with a loud shout, and the sound was heard far away. Now, these old men had seen the first temple, that's Solomon's temple, that got burnt down in 586, and now they're looking at the foundation of this new temple, which we'll call the second temple. And these old men started crying. Now, it's not clear whether they wept for sadness or whether they wept for joy. A Bible student named David E. Pratt that I found on the internet says that they were weeping for joy. Quote, "Those who were old enough to have seen the original temple, to have gone into captivity and suffered through it for many years, would surely be the ones most deeply moved now to return to Judah and see the new temple beginning construction." So they're saying, hot diggity dog, and they get so happy they start crying. Well, that could be. A lot of other people said, no, they're weeping for sadness, and I suspect that's what they were doing. What was there to be sad about? Well, the thing that is mentioned most often is they were sad because the new temple was so inferior. Now, Cambridge Commentary denies that, but Poole asserts it, and there's a lot of other people who assert it too. Well, how would the new temple be inferior to that old temple that was burnt down in 586? Well, the new temple was inferior in size, in the furniture it contained. It had inferior foundation stones, and it had no Urim and Thummim, according to Poole. Well, that'd be enough to make you cry. Backing this idea up that they were crying, the old men were crying because the new temple was so inferior, is these men are said to have a similar reaction in the book of Haggai. Haggai chapter 2, verse 3. "Who is left among you who saw this temple in its former glory? And how do you see it now? Does it not seem to you like nothing in comparison?" Well, but arguing against the idea that they were crying because the temple was so inferior is that there was not enough of the new temple built in order to be able to compare Solomon's temple burnt down in 586 and Ezra's temple here, the second temple, in 536. How can they know it's going to be so small? There was such little built of the new temple, it was hard to see yet that it was inferior. Well, what else? If they're weeping for sadness, what other factors might make them sad? Option number two, the sins that were committed to cause the destruction of the first temple. They could be thinking about that. Or the old men might be thinking, we just built the foundation. We're not going to live to see the completion of this building. We're too old. We're going to die. Or option number four, maybe the old men were thinking about the disasters of their youth. For example, the 586 exile when Jerusalem was destroyed. Option number five, they could be thinking about how small their numbers were. Oh my gosh, we're going to get wiped out. Option number six, the insignificance of Israel now compared with messianic hopes. For example, in Isaiah, when the lion will lay down with the lamb. Oh, and now we got this pitiful little rump temple we're building here. Could be a combination, of course, of all of those factors. And it could be that all their bitter memories came rushing forward when they thought about what could have been, but which was not, at least not yet. And so they're weeping for sadness. So you got people shouting for joy and weeping, perhaps for sadness. Maybe they're weeping for joy too. But at any rate, there's a lot of commotion going on in the temple. A loud shout, and the sound was heard far away. You wonder whether the surrounding people of Jerusalem might have gotten wind of this somehow when they heard all the shouting going on. Ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished Ezra chapter 3. This prepares us to go to Ezra 4 in our next audio, verses 1 through 24. And we will see that the aforesaid adversaries will cause the rebuilding of the temple to cease. So 536, laying of the foundation of the temple, a date to remember, and then the building ceases. We'll see that in our next chapter, in our next audio, which I hope you will tune into, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.